endured numerous dangers on the Arctic Ocean, and all the hardships associated with continual darkness during brutal winters. Whatever the reason, while on the return journey south, Simpson, always high-strung, had apparently gone insane, murdering two voyageurs and then shooting himself in the head. Others, however, insisted it was murder made to look like suicide in order to steal the maps and papers he carried. What truly happened will likely never be known. There wasn't time, however, to dwell much on the impermanence of things and the ghosts of the past. There'd be time enough for that in the future. For now, I had to be on my way. Turning my back on the crumbled ruins, I returned through the willows to where I'd left my canoe. I was happy to see it, for if by some freak chance my knot had come undone and the canoe had drifted off, my bones might have made a nice addition to the archaeological site. Once back on the water, I paddled on. Another 6 kilometers in my journey across North America's fourth largest lake was complete. I'd reached the eastern end of the lake. It was the evening of July 7th, meaning it had taken me 11 days to cross Great Bear. That was much faster than I'd expected. I'd estimated beforehand that, having to assume the worst with winds and ice, it would take at least 2 weeks, if not 3. When planning a solo expedition, it's imperative to always plan for worst-case scenarios. On all that vast expanse of water, I hadn't seen a soul, not one soul. In fact, I hadn't seen another person since I'd briefly stopped in at Fort Good Hope nearly a month ago. What's it like to go that long without seeing another human being, alone and isolated? Especially in a world where people increasingly can't go 10 minutes without checking their phones? Personally, I found it relaxing. Of course, I'd spent weeks alone in the wilderness before this, so solitude wasn't new to me. As for life in a major city, that's something I can't fathom. I ask people how they handle living in such massive, sprawling urban environments like Toronto, and although they try to explain it to me, I still can't quite wrap my head around it. I find those crowded, noisy places of concrete, glass, and steel stressful and suffocating, and can't stand to be in them for more than a few hours. But to each their own. A few more strokes of my paddle and I arrived at a place I recognized. It was an island in the mouth of a river draining into Great Bear Lake from the east, an island I'd been to before. A year ago, with my friend Chuck, I'd come to the eastern end of Great Bear Lake specifically to explore the Dease River and its tributaries, named after the same Dease in charge of Fort Confidence. That expedition had helped me plan this one, and so for the next 2 weeks, I figured, I'd be traveling familiar ground that I'd wandered over previously. Chuck and I had dragged, hauled, and paddled a canoe up the Dease River, and then up one of its tributaries. Finally, leaving our canoe behind, we'd hiked for miles across tundra and even a sandy desert until at last reaching the dismal lakes. At those wild and forlorn lakes set amid mountains, we turned back, retracing our steps, then paddling all the way down with the current to Great Bear. We'd begun and ended our journey at the only fly-in point available to us, Plummer's Arctic Lodge, a somewhat rustic fly-in fishing lodge about 40 kilometers west of where I was now. At one time, Great Bear's vast waters were home to as many as 5 different fishing lodges, catering to anglers seeking trophy fish. But with the decline of the sport fishing industry, now the lake was home to just 2 different lodges, separated by nearly 300 kilometers. Plummer's, the oldest, had been established back in 1968. In addition to their fly-in-only main lodge, they also operated a handful of smaller satellite camps scattered throughout the lake. Given that Plummer's lay more than 530 kilometers north of Yellowknife, getting my barrel of rations and batteries on board one of its already scheduled flights had offered me by far the most economical means of a resupply. The lodge had only just opened a week ago for the season after the ice melt, and I'd pre-arranged for my barrel of fresh rations to be on one of its scheduled flights. It hadn't been possible to know exactly when I'd reach this point in my journey, if I reached it at all, and so, in order to arrange for the barrel delivery, I needed a satellite phone to communicate. With no cell towers for thousands of kilometers across Canada's vast wilderness, There's no reception for ordinary phones or Wi-Fi. But a satellite phone, unlike an ordinary phone, works with a small antenna that allows it to receive signals from a satellite orbiting the Earth. I couldn't afford one, so I'd rented one. The minutes to operate the phone cost extra. Without them, the phone only works as a paperweight when you need to roll out maps in your tent. And I had to ration out the supply of minutes I figured I'd need to cover my journey. I followed the instructions that came with the bulky phone to get it operational, folding out the antenna and pointing it at the sky. After a pause, the phone indicated that it had picked up a signal from a satellite. I dialed up a number. It began to ring. It took 3 attempts, since it kept losing the signal, but eventually, I got through to the fishing lodge manager. He told me some surprising news. The barrel, he said, had already been delivered. A fishing guide had taken it on a motorboat the day before and dropped it at the island so that it would be there waiting for me when I arrived. This news alarmed me a little, since there was no sign of any barrel. In fact, it was the exact scenario I'd been hoping to avoid. Perhaps, if you've ever ordered something important online and then it didn't show up, only to learn that a courier had simply left it sitting on your porch when you weren't home, you'll know the feeling I had. It wasn't that I thought someone had stolen my package. With no one else around for miles, that seemed unlikely. But in the wilderness, there's a kind of animal that will happily rip open a barrel left lying around and help itself to any food inside. That's a wolverine. Wolverines are wonderful animals. A bit like a cross between a bear and a dog, they're capable of killing things much larger than themselves, including caribou. Their ability to steal food from traps and cabins is legendary, as is their toughness, including literally chewing through their own legs to escape iron traps. They're elusive, solitary creatures, ranging over vast areas. The males have home ranges that extend over 1,000 square kilometers or more. They're seldom seen by humans, even ones who spend their lives outdoors. In fact, the only time I'd ever seen a wolverine was, coincidentally, on this very river my barrel had apparently been left at. I'd seen 2 wolverines here the year before. Thus, it seemed most unfortunate that a barrel crammed with chocolate-coated energy bars, dried fruits, and jerky should have been left here of all places, with wolverines about. The lodge manager had said the guide had left the barrel on the island in a conspicuous spot, easily visible from the water, but I didn't see any sign of it. The island was close to shore, and a little bit of water is easily swam by a wolverine. A search revealed no sign of a barrel anywhere. I paddled twice around the island, searching among the alders, willows, tamaracks, and spruces for any hint of it. But if a wolverine, or a grizzly, for that matter, had happened upon my barrel and devoured its contents, I'd expect to see the mangled remains of my supplies strewn about. There was no sign of this either. Indeed, the island looked as though no one had visited it all since Chuck and I had been here the previous year. Without fresh rations, things would be difficult. I was more than 500 kilometers from my next resupply point, and the terrain that separated me from it promised to be more physically grueling than anything I'd yet encountered. What rations I still had wouldn't last long. I could cut my daily amount to stretch them out, but that would leave me without the calories required to maintain long 14 or 15-hour days. The other option, to live off the land, was something I'd done before, but time spent procuring food would severely curtail time traveling and would not yield enough calories to sustain me for the route ahead. Given there was no sign of it, it seemed likely that my barrel had never been delivered. Taking up the satellite phone, I fiddled with it again to get a signal, putting in another call to figure out what had happened to my barrel. I asked if, perhaps, there might have been some chance the guide had been confused or lost and had dropped it off at the mouth of a different river. This, the lodge manager assured me, was impossible. The guide had deposited the barrel on the exact island. He suggested that I search for it again. Personally, I've always enjoyed a good game of hide-and-seek or capture the flag, but but now really didn't seem like the best time to be playing it. I felt sure the guide had made a mistake, which I knew was the kind of thing that can happen easily on an inland sea riddled with hundreds of bays, inlets, and islands, especially since fishing guides in their motorboats tend not to stray far from a few favorite fishing spots. My worst fears were always of this sort of thing happening, and partly what had drawn me here the year before with Chuck was to ensure things would go smoothly. We were both astonished, though, to find out that the lodge manager, an amiable fellow, had in all his years on Great Bear never been to the Dease River's mouth. He shrugged and said it was a very large lake. We'd gone there with him that summer specifically to identify a spot for a resupply, and it was this point, with the exact coordinates, that I'd specified for my barrel drop. Finally, after a tense 15-minute wait, I received a satellite text informing me there'd been a terrible mistake. My barrel, it turned out, had been delivered to the wrong river. The error was attributed to a rookie fishing guide, fresh in from Saskatchewan, who'd apparently been entrusted with the delivery the day before. Upon examining a map with the manager back at the lodge, they realized their mistake. Apparently, my barrel was left on an island at the mouth of some unknown creek. I was instructed to sit tight, and a guide would be dispatched in a motorboat after dinner to retrieve the barrel and get it to me within a few hours. Somewhere right about now, I thought ruefully, a wolverine or grizzly was enjoying my chocolate almond energy bars. Plummer's Lodge was almost 40 kilometers away by boat. 2 hours later, just before 11 p.m., the sun still high in the sky, I heard the drone of a boat engine coming from the west. A small boat with an outboard motor materialized, with two men on board. They were powering fast across the bay for the distant shore, about 3 kilometers from the island I was on. Even with my exact GPS coordinates, it wasn't easy to find the correct island. From a distance, its spruces and tamaracks blended into the mainland shoreline. I watched them from the bank as they zoomed back and forth across the bay, evidently searching for the river mouth. 15 or 20 minutes later, they figured things out and powered back across the bay in the right direction. As they cruised in close to where I stood on shore, I felt slightly shy at the sight of other humans, though curious, like a wild animal. My barrel was on board, safe and sound.
"Sorry for the mistake. We effed up," said the man at the motor.
"It was my fault," said the younger man at the front of the boat, beside my barrel.
"He's a rookie," resumed the man at the back. "First season on Great Bear and he takes the barrel to the wrong place."
"Sorry," returned the other, looking at me apologetically. Such excessive conversation felt overwhelming, the noise and all, and I was kind of hoping they'd just deliver my barrel and be gone. But after almost a month without human company, another part of me felt eager to chat. I mustered some words. "Thanks. I never doubted it would arrive safely." They explained they didn't regularly come to this part of the lake to fish, and so they weren't very familiar with the area. But to make up for the confusion and delay, they thoughtfully added a 6-pack of beer to my rations. I thanked them for the beer, but explained that I didn't drink. I let them keep the beer for themselves, which seemed to make everyone happy. The barrel they brought, I quickly dumped into my nearly empty barrels. I did this because I wanted to keep my original barrels with me, which were slightly smaller than the resupply one. Plus, having journeyed so far together, I'd become attached to them. I handed them the empty barrel back and a bit of sealed-up garbage, the empty freeze-dried wrappers. "Thanks again," I said. The man at the back nodded and reversed the boat's engine, backing up away from the island's shore as he opened a beer can. They both wished me good luck, then zoomed off across the lake. I listened to the engine fade away, leaving me in absolute silence, save only for the drone of millions of mosquitoes swarming me, and then, feeling a little worn out from all the socializing, called it a night.
Chapter 10. Crossing the Divide. On the morning of July 8th, I dipped my paddle into Great Bear's clear waters for the last time.
bidding farewell to the most majestic of all lakes. Leaving the lake, I began paddling up a waterway that I found had changed little since Simpson and Deese had described it in 1838. A river inhabited by white wolves and lined with tall spruces and tamaracks along its lower reaches, which thinned out farther up, eventually giving way to windswept tundra. At its mouth, the Deese River is only about 250 meters wide, and not far up its twisting, snaking course, it narrows to less than 60. I needed to get over 100 kilometers up it, against its strong current, to a small tributary flowing in from the north. That little stream would lead me northward, to the spot where I planned to strike overland across the divide separating Great Bear's drainage basin from the Coppermine River's watershed. The first few kilometers of the river I found I could paddle against the current without too much difficulty, but soon its torturous course became blocked with rapids. Then I had to wade with the water nearly up to my waist, hauling and dragging the canoe behind or beside me while trying not to lose my footing. The year before, the combined strength of Chuck and me working together had been enough to overcome much of the river's current. Alone, I had no choice but to do more wading and dragging. This part of my journey had a slightly different feel to it than elsewhere, as here I was traveling over territory I'd seen twice before, once going upriver and then again going back downriver. I enjoy returning to old haunts as much as the next person, but they don't have quite the same magical allure of unknown places, where every bend in the river brings something new. We tend to think of the world as a fast-shrinking place, where modern technology has bridged distances. That's partly true, but the funny thing is, if you get out on the land in a canoe or on foot, the world remains just as big as it ever was. When I arrived at a certain sharp bend in the river, not quite 5 kilometers up from Great Bear Lake, I beached my canoe at the foot of a small rapid. On the far side of the river was a steep bluff, above which stood ancient spruces. This sharp bend, I knew from the prior summer with Chuck, was the site where 106 years earlier, a Canadian prospector by the name of George Douglas and his 2 companions had built a small cabin to endure the brutal cold of the long, harsh Arctic winter. Chuck and I had made a cursory investigation of the cabin's ruins, measuring its dimensions and photographing it. Douglas had sailed across Great Bear Lake that summer of 1911 on a small boat, before coming upriver here and selecting it as a spot to overwinter. Perhaps, if I were the superstitious sort, I probably wouldn't have bothered to stop now and head off into the shadows of the tall black spruces to once more gaze at decaying ruins. There's something a little eerie about abandoned, crumbling cabins in the woods. Such an isolated cabin might be charming enough in summer, but in winter, it could quickly feel like a prison. Here, north of the Arctic Circle, sub-zero temperatures last for nearly 9 months. During the worst stretch, there are over 40 days of unbroken darkness. Shut up inside a tiny, cramped cabin, the walls seem to close in a little tighter, week by week, sometimes driving the occupants mad with cabin fever. The North is replete with disturbing stories of lone trappers who, isolated for too long during long, dark winters, committed unspeakable deeds. The case of the mad trapper is perhaps the most infamous, but there are many others. Shortly before embarking on their expedition, one of Simpson and Deese's men, a certain Anderson, went crazy and ran away in the woods. Simpson himself, after exploring the river I was now venturing up, had apparently become strangely withdrawn, erratic, and paranoid, eventually one night at his campsite murdering 2 Canadians and then shooting himself in the head. Another explorer who passed over this same ground, Dr. Richardson, Sir John Franklin's trusted companion, once shot a voyageur he suspected of murdering and eating another member of the party. That kind of thing is frowned upon in canoeing circles. Before Douglas and his 2 companions had come to this lonely spot to build their cabin, the ruins of which I was now staring at, they'd stumbled upon another cabin on their way to Great Bear Lake. When they entered it, they found a scene of horror. Inside the tiny dwelling were the decomposing remains of 2 men. One of the corpses, in Douglas's own words, had his head a shapeless mass, blown out of all resemblance to anything human. A note left beside the other body told the tale. Shut up inside the cabin for months in darkness, freezing cold, and increasingly paranoid, one trapper had murdered the other, apparently shooting him in the head while he slept. The murderer, after confessing the deed in writing, had scrawled on the paper, "I am not crazy," and then ended his own life by drinking poison. Among the Algonquian-speaking peoples of the subarctic forests, for generations stories were told of individuals who, during unusually hard winters when game became scarce, turned into wendigos to survive, which meant they ate human flesh. Wendigos were believed to be possessed by an evil spirit that gave them superhuman strength. Many of the fur traders and voyageurs who lived in the fur country ended up sharing the Ojibwe and Cree beliefs about the existence of wendigos. In the spruce woods, I circled the crumbling ruins of Douglas's cabin. The roof had collapsed and part of the log walls had fallen in. In one corner was an impressively crafted fireplace, made with rocks carefully arranged to shelter the vital heat and chinked with clay taken from the riverbanks. Douglas and his two friends had managed to survive the winter without mishap, departing the area the next summer. They'd come to investigate copper deposits, but nothing ever came of that. The forest was gradually swallowing the cabin's ruins. Aside from its stone hearth, in time there would be nothing left. Slowly it would vanish back into the wilderness. I took one last look at it, then headed back to where I'd left my canoe. At night, as I lay in my tent, the river's rapids rumbling a short distance away, the air thick with the ceaseless buzz of millions of mosquitoes, and occasionally, echoing across untold miles, the howls of Arctic wolves, thoughts of solitary trappers and wendigos would drift into my mind. Then, curled up in my sleeping bag, I'd eventually drift off. Upstream travel on the Dease I did with a mix of paddling, poling, wading, and dragging. The days were long and exhausting, attacked as I was by hordes of blackflies and increasingly by bulldog flies, a type of large biting horsefly that appears around July at these latitudes. When it bites, it feels more like a bee sting and leaves a welt behind. My legs were daily becoming more scraped and bruised from smashing into unseen rocks while wading in the river. Some of the bruises on my thighs were the result of the canoe hitting me as I hauled with all my strength to pull it toward me against the rapids. My remaining toenails were black from banging against rocks, and I was mindful, as ever, not to lose my footing and slip and smash my head off any number of jagged rocks in the rapids. My feet also had a rash from constant wetness. Despite wearing hip waders, in some places where the river rose higher, or when I stumbled in the current, water would flood into the waders. I'd empty them afterward, but my socks stayed damp. But, as bad as my feet and legs looked, the canoe's hull looked worse. It now sported 6 or 7 bad gashes. There was also a growing patch near the starboard side where the fabric was badly worn with threads visible. The river's frequent shallow, rock-strewn rapids had continued to grind away at the hull, since I had little choice but to scrape and drag the heavily loaded canoe over those jagged rocks. If I were to stop and portage all of the river's dozens of rapids, I'd be lucky to get even halfway across the Arctic tundra before snows buried me in the fall. Otherwise, things were going well. Mentally, I was still very much enjoying my journey. My long days of ceaseless upriver travel were yielding about 20 to 25 kilometers of progress a day. There weren't many sections suitable for poling. The river was often either too deep for it or too swift. But in certain stretches between rapids, where the current slackened, I was able to do more paddling. In these places, the scenery took on an intriguing aspect, with lonely mountains surrounding the river and great sandstone outcrops towering high above it. On some of these crags were gigantic nests of sticks, as large as a small boat. Eagle nests, although their astonishing dimensions made them look as though they were home to mythical birds like griffins. Fish were plentiful in the river, especially Arctic graylings, pike, and burbot, a type of freshwater cod. Chuck and I had feasted nearly every day on fish. But alas, on my journey, fishing was a diversion I couldn't afford unless it came down to it as a necessity. There were also small bird nests along the river's shore, carefully camouflaged in sedges and grasses, but I didn't have the heart to help myself to any of the eggs. My principles are to cause as little disturbance as possible, leaving, as far as I'm able, only footprints. I will admit, though, that I've been mighty tempted at times to throw a rock at the odd ptarmigan or grouse that crosses my path. Wolves, too, were numerous, and as curious about me as others of their kind had been. A few days upriver, I was in the middle of a very long stretch of wading through rapids, hauling the canoe behind me, and was almost lulled into a daydream by the sounds of the water, the repetitive nature of the work, and the all-encompassing solitude. What snapped me back to attention was a sudden flash of white on the high opposite bank. I glanced up to see something dart behind a clump of willows and then reemerge a few seconds later. It was an all-white wolf. Such white fur helps Arctic wolves blend in with their surroundings in winter when stalking prey. The wolf poked its head out of the willows, staring right at me. Then, drawn by irresistible curiosity, she crept out, sat down, and just watched me passively. Or perhaps I've merely been misreading all of these wolf encounters, and they've been simply contemplating me the whole time as a nice addition to their diet. In the lower parts of the river, there was lots of ice damage along the riverbanks. During the annual breakup, the ice rushes downstream on the current, smashing into the spruces overlooking the river and leaving gashes in their trunks high off the ground. These gashes have confused and alarmed a number of newcomers to northern rivers upon first sight of them, wondering what manner of beast could have wrought such destruction. The answer, of course, is ice. But if you want to terrify the wits out of a group of young campers, tell them it was bears. I was often forced to sleep wherever I could find a spot, on rocks, gravel, or wherever else I'd happened to stop, exhausted for the night. As before, if it had been a question of going downriver, I could afford to be selective, choosing anywhere to sleep that I liked. But with upriver travel, I simply had to force myself to push on for as long as I could. My second day hauling and paddling upriver, I passed through a high, twisting limestone canyon filled with a mix of rapids and deep pools. At the entrance to this canyon, a great rock pillar rose straight out of the river like a lighthouse. Nesting in the sheer cliffs were dozens of swallows that feed on the abundant swarms of insects. The year before, on our return journey, Chuck and I got caught in a July snowstorm in this canyon and were forced to canoe on through the snows, which reduced visibility greatly. Temperature drops of 20 degrees or more can happen over a single day in the Arctic, when frigid masses of air drift down from the Arctic Ocean. I was now only about 130 kilometers inland of that icy sea. Fortunately, this time when I entered the canyon, the weather was mild, but the water levels, I noted, were higher than the previous year, probably on account of the later snowmelt. To get through the canyon would require a delicate mix of paddling and wading along the edge of rapids where the current was strong. What I wanted to avoid at all costs was portaging. In the center of the canyon was a sizable rapid that roared over exposed rocks in a spot where the river narrowed. On its right side was a gravel bar with some willows growing on it. I landed my canoe on that gravel bar, deciding to try hauling it up through the rapids. Grabbing the bow with one hand, I towed it up to the edge of the rapids while trying to stay on shore myself. It took some careful handling to get the canoe up and past the rocks, knowing that if it caught sideways in the current, it would flip over. Once up the initial bit of white water, I edged into the river knee-deep, in order to drag the canoe farther up to a place where I could safely jump in and resume paddling. The force of the current rushing against my legs caused me to momentarily stumble, but luckily I managed to recover without landing face first in the river. Another few steps and I was able to bring the canoe alongside me and leap back in. I paddled hard against the current, winding around the next bend in the canyon. A short distance ahead were more rapids and a small but furious waterfall, where the river plunged over big boulders. To haul up the thundering cataract would be impossible and dangerous. There was no choice but to portage around it. So I landed my canoe on the left side, just outside the last of the canyon walls, to begin carrying the loads ahead on foot. Getting everything around the cascade required climbing precariously over boulders with my heavy loads, and occasionally leaping across small channels where the torrent of raging water surged through. It wasn't the kind of place where you'd want to slip. Afterward, the river calmed down a bit and I could paddle. In places, it flowed past big sandy beaches with thick willow bushes. These sandy beaches made for pleasant campsites, aside from the abundance of bulldog flies. My tent, a little worn after nearly 2 months of travel and use, I discovered had a few small holes through which, alarmingly, black flies were invading. Fortunately, I was able to patch them with some tape. 4 days into journeying up the river, I was forced to halt early for the night. A storm was gathering on the horizon. The wind had been fierce all day, which, when combined with the current, had made progress painfully slow. By now the spruces had thinned out almost entirely, leaving only thickets of waist-high willows stretching for miles in all directions. A lone willow-clad mountain with a rocky summit was visible on the horizon. I hurried to make camp on a bank overlooking the river before the storm was unleashed. After months of camping, my routine had become second nature. Before the skies could open up, I managed to get the tent up, my canoe and barrels secured, a fire going with water gathered and boiled, my thermos filled with tea, and a freeze-dried meal cooked. As I sat finishing my dinner looking out over the winding river, which was now quite small, the skies grew darker and more threatening. I climbed into my tent just as the first crack of thunder boomed across the land. Rain lashed against my tent as it shook in the fierce winds, but inside I at least felt snug and dry. The storm was perhaps a little too close for comfort, with repeated flashes of lightning and loud bursts of thunder. But I trusted that my little tent was lower to the ground than the hills, mountains, and some scattered spruces, so that lightning shouldn't pose too much of a danger. Eventually, the winds carried the storm away, and I fell asleep. The wind continued fierce and cold the next day, coming as it did from the Arctic Ocean, but I splashed and waded along against it, reaching by early evening the little tributary I'd been seeking. Known as Sandy Creek, it's a little creek that, as might be guessed, is rather sandy. In places, the stream is surrounded by high vertical banks that make it impossible to see the land beyond them, but on the positive side, they provide shelter from the strong winds. I towed my canoe with a rope up Sandy Creek, wading through the water ahead, which was easy to do now. There were no longer any rocks to bump into in the clear water. The creek forked and grew steadily smaller, but still I splashed on. It was imperative that I push as far up the stream as possible, tracing it to little more than a trickle. Once I'd left the creek, I'd be embarking on the longest portage of my entire expedition, right across the great divide that separates the huge watershed of Great Bear Lake from the Coppermine River, in order to link the chain of waterways I needed to complete my journey. Draining into the Coppermine are the Dismal Lakes, and these wild lakes would be where I needed to get to in order to resume paddling. It was a portage that I expected to take days to complete, with the total distance, given all my loads, totaling a fearsome amount, perhaps 40 or 50 kilometers. Generally, in canoeing terms, anything in excess of 500 meters is deemed a long portage. And as Bill Mason, the Canadian canoe expert, put it, anyone who says they enjoy portaging is either a liar or crazy. After a few hours of wading up the stream, I came upon a large sandy bar on the creek's eastern bank that I recognized as a place where Chuck and I had camped the previous year. A big rack of caribou antlers lay in the sand, right where I'd left them. No one, it seemed, had been to this lonely stream in the time since. It was here at this beach where we'd left our canoe and barrels behind, before beginning the long, arduous trek over land to the Dismal Lakes with only our backpacks and the bare essentials. The hike had been long and wearisome, with plagues of black flies nearly the whole way aside from when the wind was stiff. Chuck, in his considered opinion, had deemed the notion of trying to haul a canoe, two barrels, and a backpack across such a huge stretch as mad. He was wise like that. One thing perhaps not immediately obvious is just how much more difficult hiking, and especially portaging, becomes when there's no trail to follow. Not only is it a matter of having to simultaneously navigate and lug a heavy canoe over your head, or struggle under the weight of a heavy barrel, the real issue is the lack of solid, level ground to hike on. Chuck, having gotten a taste from his travels with me of what portaging without trails is like, once described it this way: "I would say very few people understand how difficult it is to walk from point A to point B without being on a proper trail. It is immeasurably more difficult and dangerous without a hard-packed surface under your feet. You start to wander like a dog, traveling 3 or 4 miles just for 1 mile of forward progress, stepping around obstacles and backtracking. Putting your foot in the wrong place is very likely to cause a twisted ankle or other injury." Chuck and I, since we hadn't been portaging but merely hiking for the sake of exploring, had taken a somewhat indirect route to the lakes. In the process, we'd wandered across a surprising variety of terrains, from flat tundra plains overgrown with dwarf birch shrubs, to snowfields that remained in shaded valleys, to surreal sandy deserts that made us feel as if we'd somehow strayed into the Sahara. Then there were the swampy sphagnum bogs, rolling beautiful hills with spruce groves, and quiet, meadow-filled valleys. Eventually, we reached the tip of the Dismal Lakes, which we found windswept and inhospitable, such that canoeing would have been impossible with the waves. After camping a night there, we retraced our steps homeward bound to the canoe and barrels. This time, however, I pressed on farther up the creek, beyond where Chuck and I had left it on our overland trek. Based on what I'd read in Douglas's journals and those of earlier explorers like Simpson and Deese, I hoped it might be possible for me to make it farther up the stream, just as they must have. They'd all come this way on their travels, since they too had crossed the divide to the copper mine. Simpson and Deese had done so with a party of about 15 men carrying wooden rowboats, which they'd built to navigate the copper mine and from there the treacherous waters of the Arctic Ocean. If I could make it farther upstream, it would help reduce the length of the portage needed to reach the Dismal Lakes. Since I had a smaller boat than any of those predecessors, and the water levels seemed higher than they'd been before, I was optimistic about my chances. Another thing not immediately obvious is that the frequent alterations between paddling or poling and wading, a necessity for upriver travel, cause water to accumulate in the canoe. This is from water running off pant legs and boots once climbing back into the canoe. It might not seem like much water could accumulate in that manner, but it certainly begins to add up quite fast, even when, like me, you take the time to stand on one leg, letting most of the water run off before stepping back in. The accumulating water adds weight to the canoe, not only slowing it down, but also drenching any backpack stowed in the boat. In a waterlogged backpack, with its increased weight, is not a pleasant thing to carry on lengthy portages. Luckily for me, as a boy I'd learned an old woodsman's trick to avoid my backpack getting wet in the canoe. Cut some willow branches, lay them down in the bottom, then put your backpack over them. This inch or so of space the willows, or any other branch, provide is sufficient to keep your gear nice and dry. Knowing in advance that this grueling portage would be one of the most difficult parts of my expedition, I'd carefully plotted ahead of time how best to tackle it. With one eye on my budget and the other on my route maps, I'd specifically devised my resupply points to allow me to be traveling as light as possible in this section. Thus, my resupply at the end of Great Bear, and a second one I hoped to obtain a month or so later when I reached a place on the Coppermine River where a float plane could safely land. This would allow me to carry rations for only a month over this stretch, a lot less than elsewhere. Indeed, by this point, I've been steadily eating up all my surplus rations that had been left over when I reached the end of Great Bear, allowing me to further lessen my loads and bulk up at least a little for the grueling portaging. The cart, too, I hoped, might finally prove useful. Back in Sudbury, I'd also studied the accounts and hand-drawn maps of early explorers like Simpson, Deese, Douglas, and other historic figures who'd been over this terrain, comparing their notes with modern satellite imagery in the hope of pinpointing a route that would minimize portaging by hitting certain small lakes and ponds that appeared scattered like raindrops across the tundra. Beyond these measures, I had no other tricks to play. Sometimes, hard work is the only thing that will succeed. Daunting as such a long portage appeared, my mindset was that simple persistence would pay off. Like the tortoise and the hare again, I just told myself, slow and steady wins the race. The high water levels, it turned out, did allow me to advance up the little sandy creek, and even farther than I dared hope. I ventured way beyond the point where Chuck and I had abandoned the creek, managing to make it another 20 kilometers up. This took me past numerous sand hills and up and around a great many S-bends in the river. These repeated S-bends were so extreme as to make the creek resemble a crazy straw or a giant python. At night, camped on the creek, I could hear the howls of a pack of wolves echoing out from distant mountains. Wolves were clearly frequent visitors in these parts. I'd often come across their scat on the tundra. From the white hairs in it, it seemed they'd been feeding on caribou. Early the next morning, after a few more hours of paddling and wading up the tiny, winding stream, I reached a point where I judged it time to begin the dreaded overland trek. It was to be the portage of all portages, nearly 40 kilometers in the aggregate, with no trail to follow. I'd arrived at a sand and gravel ridge that appeared to be an esker, formed by the retreat of the glaciers northward about 10,000 years earlier. It ran off to the northwest, the direction where I needed to head. Wolf tracks were faintly visible in its sand. If wolves had gone along the ridge, I figured I'd follow their example. All of my rations I was able to compress down into a single barrel, leaving the other one empty. This was excellent, as it meant I could simply carry the empty barrel with the canoe, reducing my loads from 4 to 3. And thereby cutting down the total distance by as much as 20 kilometers. I began by strapping on my backpack. It was my lightest load, weighing no more than 50 pounds. It was also much more comfortable to wear than the barrel. For that reason, I always took it first on portages, as the extra spring in my step let me scout things out more thoroughly, thereby picking out the best ground for the heavier and more difficult loads to follow. In the wilderness, a straight line between two points is seldom the shortest way, especially if it means making your way across willow thickets, swampy ground, or boulder fields where you can twist an ankle. Thus I set off. The sun was beating down, but a brisk wind kept things cool. I wore a mesh bug net to minimize the annoyance of the blood-sucking insects. Navigating was easy enough. I knew which direction to head, and there was a range of high hills as landmarks to guide me. The sandy, pebble-strewn esker made for good hiking terrain. It curved in an arc around a pond, then took me up a slope and across tundra with low willow bushes. Once over a spruce-clad ridge, I passed on to a great sandy slope. At the end of this sandy stretch, having hiked about a kilometer, I set down my backpack, refueled with some water and an energy bar, then returned to fetch my next load. My reason for these short intervals was not wanting to leave any of my packs unattended for too long, which seemed unwise with grizzlies and wolverines wandering about. Plus, regular breaks helped make the overall portage seem more manageable. When it came time to take the canoe, I again experimented with the cart. I strapped the canoe on it and put a number of miscellaneous items inside, such as my waders. It worked well enough across the sand esker, but once I'd passed on to the hilly terrain or over willows, it was much less practical. It was the kind of thing that might have worked effectively with two people, one pulling from the front, the other pushing from the back, allowing even more things, such as the backpack and barrels, to be put inside the canoe. I made a mental note of this for the purpose of future trips. Of course, it didn't do much good to dwell on such things at the time. Across a valley from this first leg of my portage, I could see a snowfield tucked beneath the bottom of a large ridge. Back in 1911, Douglas had described this very snowfield. Chuck and I had also seen it, and it was encouraging to think that warmer average temperatures hadn't, at least yet, seemed to have changed it much. While all this landscape would be buried in snow most of the year, by June the snows usually melt across most of the low Arctic. However, in this unique spot, as in a few others, the shade of the encircling ridge keeps the ice and snow preserved year-round. The next leg of the trek took me across vast fields of willow shrubs and dwarf birches. The willows and birches weren't any higher than my knees, so hiking among them wasn't much trouble. In a few places, I startled willow ptarmigans. Unlike the grouse in the woods near where I grew up, the ptarmigans startled here didn't fly off very far. They simply flew up a short couple of strides and then landed again in plain sight. Like other animals, birds that haven't been exposed much to human hunting over many generations remain remarkably easy to approach. This included a mother ptarmigan with 6 good-sized chicks that followed her across the tundra. They scurried off as I passed by, but they never went far, and I saw them on each trip back and forth with my different loads. They would have made a nice meal, but I didn't have the heart to do it, though I certainly thought about it. I next headed into a hilly region, passing among hills thinly clad with spruces and an abundance of wild berries, none of which were yet ripe. These sheltered hills seemed to be a favorite haunt of wildlife. Wolf tracks were visible in the sand, and I could easily imagine a grizzly would enjoy the berry buffet when they turned ripe. From the summit of one of these hills, I surveyed the route ahead. In the far distance, I could see mountains with some snow on their upper slopes. Beneath these lonely mountains was where I needed to get to, the Dismal Lakes. It was the high-strung Simpson who'd given them that name. In the spring of 1838, when he and his companions came over a high ridge and first caught sight of these narrow, interconnected lakes set amid windswept mountains, Simpson noted, "Never have I seen a land so desolate and dismal as that which stretched before me." It was precisely that desolate and dismal place I was trying so hard to reach. Luckily, just beneath the hills I'd hiked into were 3 ponds in a row and then a small lake, allowing me to paddle a bit and refill my empty water bottle. The canoe I went back to simply dragging, which I found faster than fiddling with the cart. The empty barrel I strapped on my back when dragging the canoe, thereby eliminating the need for a fourth trip. Between each of these ponds, a short portage allowed me to skip ahead to the next one. Then, after crossing the last of the 3, I noticed something odd. The ground just beyond the pond was flattened and trampled down, almost as if by vehicles or a stampede of elephants. But there were no roads for hundreds of kilometers, and the last Arctic elephants, mastodons and woolly mammoths, had died out millennia ago. Upon taking a closer look, it hit me what had made these rutted, muddy tracks. Thousands of hoofs, marching in a great herd. They were from the caribou migration, when the animals form vast herds beyond counting and march across the tundra for hundreds of miles. The dwarf birch bushes were all grazed down, and the ground churned up to the width of a 3-lane road by marching hoofs. The herd must have passed recently, within days it seemed. Perhaps the howling of the wolves I'd heard was from a pack stalking them. I scanned across the sea of tundra that unfolded before me for any sign of the herd. A white speck was bobbing along on the horizon. I couldn't make out what it was, so I used my camera to zoom in on it. It was a lone caribou, a straggler who must have fallen behind. I resumed my portage, carrying the canoe and 2 loads across the rutted up passage that the herd had passed over. Eventually, just as I was completing the last load, the straggler approached. To my surprise, at the sight of me, the caribou walked right up to me. I informed the caribou that the herd had gone west, and if that she didn't dally, she might yet catch up with them. The caribou didn't seem to entirely understand me, but nonetheless, she trotted off in the right direction. A few minutes later, as I was busy launching the canoe into the small lake, two more caribou materialized. These ones paid no attention to me and hurried on their way. I, too, had to be on my way, north to the Dismal Lakes. The ponds and the lake raised my spirits greatly, as they cut down on the portaging by allowing me to paddle a little. When I reached the end of the lake, which took only a few minutes, I resumed travel on foot. The lake brought me to more big sand hills scattered with black spruce. On the far side of these hills, I found a great sandy slope that ran down to another beautiful lake. To reach it, I dragged my canoe over the hills and down the slope, then carried my other loads up and over. It had been about 10 hours of solid portaging, but I calculated that I still wasn't even halfway through yet. Exhausted, I camped on the sandy beach for the night. The portage I'd just have to continue in the morning. In the meantime, after a fire on the beach, I curled up in my tent on what was a cold, windy night. Just as I was getting comfortable, the howling of wolves rang out across the distant hills. I wondered whether the friendly caribou had managed to catch up in time. Chapter 11. Through the Dismal Lakes. I woke early, eager for another hard day of portaging. I figured if I could just get this dreaded portage done, it would be a great weight off my shoulders. Coming into the journey, I knew it would be one of the most physically demanding aspects of it, and thus if I could pull it off, I'd feel that much closer to reaching my end goal. At this point, despite trekking and paddling nearly 1,500 kilometers from the Yukon, that end goal still felt pretty unreachable. So I tried to focus on the task at hand, and not dwell too much on all the stories I had heard. Stories about how bad the storms got after mid-August in the barren lands west of Hudson Bay. In my canoe, I was soon paddling hard across the little lake I'd camped on. It was a short paddle to reach the lake's north shore. Here, there was a range of steep, rolling hills covered with short tundra grass and small stones. I landed directly beneath the hills, strapped on my backpack, and began climbing. My legs burned as I ascended the steep slope, but my excitement at what I might see from the summit carried me on. Coming over the crest of the hill, a magnificent view unfolded before me. The range of steep hills formed a sort of crescent, beneath which lay a sheltered marshy valley and a small, hourglass-shaped lake. Beyond the hills were great ridges, which in places rose up to rocky summits. And just past the lake, tucked behind the hills but below the encircling mountainous ridge, was a small gap. I recognized it from the year before with Chuck. It was where I needed to head. I cut down the windy, barren hillside toward the valley. It was a little marshy in places, but otherwise not difficult to cross. About 750 meters of hiking brought me to the shores of the Hourglass Lake. I left my backpack there and retraced my steps across the plain, over the windswept hills, and down the far side where I'd left my canoe and the rest of my gear. Next, I strapped on the big, heavy barrel, and with the paddle to support me, began climbing the hill again. I staggered in the gusts of wind under the weight of the barrel on the steep hillside, but balancing myself with the paddle, I kept climbing. Up on those wild slopes, I could see for miles in all directions. There wasn't the slightest hint of any human-made object to be seen anywhere, or another person. It was a remarkably beautiful, soul-filling sight. When I finished that load, I took a bunch of cashews and some jerky, drank cold water, and then went back for the canoe. Hauling the canoe up the hillside required a kind of running start, dragging it with one hand while holding the other hand out to maintain my balance in the wind and on the steep slope. Inside the canoe were, among other things, my empty barrel, waders, fishing rod, and bailer, all of which slid down to the stern of the canoe as I kept hauling it up the hill. Panting heavily, I told myself that this hard work would be rewarded with an easy toboggan ride down the far side. The summits were a bit rocky, so I lifted the canoe partially up and carried it across the barren hilltop. Once over the top, the canoe did toboggan down nicely, with me jogging alongside after it. When we reached the bottom, I took the bow rope, tied it into a harness, and began dragging the assemblage across the tundra like a dog sled. The improvised harness worked well, and I even jogged a bit, excited to reach the Hourglass Lake. But these early enthusiasms didn't last long. The lake was only a half kilometer long, and I was soon across it. On its far side, more challenging terrain confronted me. A mix of willow shrubs, dwarf birch, and bog, infested with millions of black flies, set within a long, narrow gully. This gully ran for nearly 5 kilometers, terminating at last at the tip of the Dismal Lakes. Of that 5 kilometers, all would have to be portaged aside from one pond of about 500 meters that I could paddle across. I strapped on my backpack and began hiking through willows, up and over a ridge, and then down into the gully. Swarms of black flies and mosquitoes attacked me as soon as I dropped into the gully. Their itchy bites on my neck, wrists, and waistline were maddening, but I pushed on, trying to move as quickly as I could. Down in the gully, however, the ground was wet and boggy. My hiking boots were soon drenched and heavy, slowing me down. Sinking into this morass with a pack on my back was exhausting, but still I trudged on with clouds of black flies, mosquitoes, sandflies, and bulldog flies feasting on my flesh as I did so. Eventually, after nearly 3 kilometers, I reached the edge of the narrow pond and unstrapped my backpack. Then I turned round and hiked back through the boggy lowlands, the bugs still swarming me. When I finally made it back to the Hourglass Lake, where my other loads were waiting, I flopped down on the soft moss, exhausted. I rested comfortably in the moss as a cool breeze blew away the swarms of bugs. Needing more energy, I fished out some dried strawberries, goji berries, and almonds from my barrel. But the breeze soon died, allowing the bugs to resume their assault. So I put away my snacks, lifted the heavy barrel up onto my knee and then onto my back, strapping it across my chest. With my other paddle, the bent shaft one, I set off again through the willows into the gully. Maybe it was the blood smearing my beard and neck, but the storms of bugs seemed only to get worse on this third trip through the gully. I was wearing gloves, but the black flies in particular were mercilessly attacking my exposed wrists. Still, I staggered on, knowing that to rest would only allow more bugs to feast on me. To hike 3 kilometers with a heavy barrel strapped on your back is perhaps not too difficult on solid ground or with a trail to follow, but the boggy soil made hiking twice as exhausting as would ordinarily be the case. When I at last reached the pond where I left my backpack, I set down the barrel and decided I needed some relief. Normally, I use bug spray only sparingly, if at all. Frankly, I don't like spraying chemicals on my skin or clothing. Plus, as I've mentioned, it was my good fortune to have had a family home surrounded by black swamps of foul water that bred great clouds of mosquitoes, granting me a high tolerance as a result. But there are times, such as when portaging multiple loads across boggy lowlands infested with millions of black flies and other blood-sucking insects, when bug spray comes in handy. I packed several containers of it and fished one out of my backpack now. I knew from past experience in northern swamps that bug spray is of limited effectiveness here, but there are also times when even limited effectiveness seems like a worthwhile improvement. So, I liberally doused my clothing with the spray. It seemed to partially diminish the hordes of black flies and mosquitoes. I then hiked back across the gully for the fourth time in order to fetch my canoe. By the time I reached it, the bugs were swarming me as fiercely as ever. I wasted little time slipping on the harness I'd made and dragging the canoe behind me for the fifth and final trip through the gully. My legs and hips burned, but I kept going. After about a kilometer of dragging, however, I was starting to feel almost woozy from the storms of black flies biting me, something I'd felt only once before, when one July I'd hiked for days into the heart of muskeg in the Hudson Bay lowlands. Apparently, excessive bites can lead to something called black fly fever, which, apart from the fever itself, can bring on symptoms like headache, nausea, and swollen lymph nodes. But I was determined to reach the Dismal Lakes that day, come what may, and so I splashed some refreshing bog water in my face, inhaled deeply, and pushed on. When I finally reached the pond where my barrel and backpack were waiting, I pushed the canoe in the water, quickly loaded it, and jumped in. The distance from the end of this pond to the tip of the Dismal Lakes was approximately 1.7 kilometers through willows, spruces, bog, and some hills. With my three separate loads to carry plus two return trips, that meant I actually had five times that amount, 8.5 kilometers, to cover before I could rest easy at the Dismal Lakes. Having reached the end of the pond, I set off with my backpack, plunging once more into clouds of black flies that made sure to exact their toll for the passage. The way forward took me first through low-lying boggy ground, then past ancient, stunted spruces as the ground descended up a long hill. As I came up a higher ridge, for the first time I caught sight of the Dismal Lakes. They didn't look at all dismal to me. Shimmering dark blue water set beneath wild mountain ridges, and great green hills with bald rock outcrops. In the far distance, beyond the lake, rose a great mountain barrier with patches of snow on it. Some stunted spruces stood on the nearer side of the lake, but mostly the land was open, windswept tundra. The sight of the Dismal Lakes felt a bit surreal. Some effect of the light, water, and distance made the mountains and snow on the far shore seem like a floating mirage. Or perhaps it was just loss of blood from millions of black fly bites. The lake was still another 700 meters ahead, but the sight of it renewed my energy, and I pushed on with my backpack down the ridge to it. The shrieking of an Arctic tern, evidently nesting somewhere nearby, greeted me as I dropped my backpack on the tundra just above a small beach. A cold wind was blowing hard across the lake, lapping waves against the shore. It took several more hours of hard work to finish transporting my other loads. By the time I'd finished, it was 7 p.m., and I was exhausted. I celebrated the completion of the portage with a freeze-dried meal and some Labrador tea. Best of all, the fierce winds sweeping across the lake dispelled the clouds of bugs. I could finally breathe easy, removing my mesh bug net. My throat was bloodied with bites. Flipping the collar up on my jacket, I huddled for warmth by the little blaze of a driftwood fire I'd kindled. I had two other reasons to celebrate. First, I'd reached the most northern part of my journey across Canada's Arctic. The Dismal Lakes are just 90 kilometers south of the Arctic Ocean's Coronation Gulf, which forms part of the Northwest Passage. Second, I'd crossed another major watershed divide, having now succeeded in passing out of Great Bear Lake's drainage basin into the Coppermine River watershed. This meant that for the first significant stretch of my journey, I'd actually soon have a river to paddle with the current. Before I could do that, though, I'd have to get off this windswept beach. The Dismal Lakes, a chain of three long, interconnected lakes set amid mountains, are notoriously windy. When Chuck and I had arrived here the previous year, we'd seen nothing at all encouraging to the idea of canoeing. The wind had been fierce the entire time we were at the lakes, and I could easily appreciate historical accounts of past travelers trapped for days here by tremendous gusts that made paddling impossible. On a short journey, such a delay wouldn't be too much of a concern, but for me, with thousands of kilometers of paddling still to do across any number of lakes that might leave me windbound, any delays were liable to cause trouble. I set up my tent in the winds, anchoring it with guy lines. Then I crawled inside. I just had to hope that morning would bring calm weather.
The wind raged that night. My tent poles moaned and nearly buckled from the pressure of the blast. Sand, whipped up by the gusts as they swept across the beach below, blew all over the tent and even inside through its screen doors. Worried that my little tent would blow away, I crawled out in the night to check on the pegs. Several had lifted right out of the ground, pulled up by the force of the winds sweeping under the tent fly. I jammed them back down and piled rocks on top to help hold them, shivering as I did so. Back inside, I rubbed my arms to keep warm and burrowed back into my sleeping bag. Sleeping I found difficult in spite of my exhaustion, on account of the racket made by wind gusts rumbling my tent's rain fly and constantly pounding and shaking its nylon walls. When I woke in the morning, the wind sounded as fierce as ever. Sometimes, though, from inside a tent, wind can sound worse than it actually is. Thinking this might be one of those times, I poked my head out the tent to take a look. It wasn't one of those times. The wind was as strong as it sounded. It was far too rough to paddle. I'd never make it off the beach in such a powerful headwind. All day, in fact, the wind never let up. I waited anxiously for any break,